It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. The division of motor vehicles isn't generally associated with speedy service, but if you feel like you've spent even more time waiting at Wisconsin's DMVs lately, you're not alone. A reporter tells us what's happened and why the issue hasn't received very much attention. If you've been to the DMV lately, how long did you have to wait? Did you get a sense of why it was taking so long? Or maybe you didn't have to wait at all. Either way, share your story with us. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Keegan Kyle is an investigative reporter for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. His recent piece there explores why people are waiting longer at the Wisconsin DMV. Keegan, welcome back to the Morning Show.
Thanks for having me.
In 2014, Governor Walker set out to decrease the amount of time people are waiting at the DMV. Why did he do that?
Well, at the time, the state estimates for both how long people were waiting on the phone and also how long people were waiting at service centers was lower than what the state wanted to meet. It wanted to get to the point that at least 80% of people waiting on the phone got help within 2 minutes. And at least 80% of people at service centers got help within 20 minutes.
So they were waiting longer than that. Do we know how much longer people were waiting on the phone before someone answered?
Well, the way that the DMV tracks their wait time performance is through a percentage of their total volume. So in 2014, 73% of people were waiting on the phone longer than 2 minutes. And just a little over 80% were waiting at service centers longer than 20 minutes.
So what goals did Governor Walker set for the DMV in 2014 then?
So they wanted to hit that 80% mark, and it nearly hit the 80% mark for phone calls in 2015, and it well exceeded the 80% mark for service centers in 2015. But every year since then, the DMV has seen worsening performance in both aspects, and that's why we wrote the article. At service centers, people have been waiting longer and longer every single year, and phone calls have been taking longer and longer every single year. And now both areas fall below the state's goal.
Keegan Kyle is an investigative reporter for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. We're talking about wait times at the DMV. What's your story? Share it with us at 800-642-1234. Keegan, you report that the state has struggled to cut wait times, as we've talked about, even though the DMV has received fewer calls lately and employees are working more quickly as they serve customers. That seems like a dichotomy to me. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, it is an odd fact about these worsening wait times. The DMV has done a lot to try to push more customers to its website, where you can do a lot of services now rather than going to service centers. So when I talked to the DMV about their worsening wait times, one idea that they had about why the wait times have worsened is that on the phones in particular, they're now dealing with a more complex client. So it's taking longer for them on phone calls to help people. But their data still shows some complexities with that, because in June this year there was data showing that DMV workers were working actually much faster than they have previously at service centers, but they're still seeing very slow wait times.
So when we talk about complex questions that people are asking, what kinds of questions are we talking about here?
Well, I think there's a lot of factors that go into wait time, and it's not entirely clear from the data what factors are most driving this situation. One other thing is personnel and staffing at the DMV service centers. So the DMV said that when their wait times were actually much better back in 2015, they shifted some staffing to another unit to try to cut wait times for new vehicle titles. And every year since then, wait times at the actual service centers have been worsening. So it's possible that reduction in staff for another task has meant that people are waiting longer in line.
Do we have fewer DMV service centers in Wisconsin now than we did, say, 10 years ago? Could that be part of it?
It could be. I'm not sure, though, if what the numbers are now from 10 years ago.
Because I know that in a lot of smaller communities, the DMV center may only be open one day a week for a limited number of hours, and people complain about that too. But what kind of attention have wait times received from state lawmakers?
Very little, if any. So I do track the state budget and the legislature as part of my work, and wait times have not really come up at state policy discussion levels. There was no discussion of it in the last budget cycle to really change resources to address wait times. There's also no proposal in the State Department of Transportation's budget this year or next year to address wait times. So this has been kind of a trend that's been going under the radar.
Let's take a call. Sue is with us in Oconomowoc. Sue, welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. Well, I think the DMV is getting a bad rap. Now, they've just built a new facility in Waukesha, and yes, you do have to wait, and they give numbers, they try to keep you moving, but you know, these people are working with the public, and the public are there with lots of questions, whether they're easy questions or not. And I think the DMV is trying really hard to make sure that we get in and out and get the information we need, without just putting, you know, the employees on a clock and saying, okay, you have 2 minutes to talk to this person, and that's it.
Sue, thanks for that. Keegan?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, one other thing that the DMV told us is that they are dealing with more customers at the service centers. So so far this year, they've had about 1.6 million visitors, which is about 3.5% more.
Why is that?
Last year. I don't know. It's really confusing because of how much of a push there has been to send more people to online services. So it's strange to see an uptick at the physical service.
Could part of it be people looking for to get IDs so they could vote or something like that?
It's possible. So that's a new change since, you know, 2014, as the state now has voter ID, and more people may be going to service centers to get IDs for elections.
And they have been pushing people to get to go online, but there are some things you just have to physically go in for. So I guess, do you know if there's a plan to bring more services online?
No, I don't think so. I talked to the DMV about their budget proposal and whether they would make any budget modifications, but I didn't really get an indication that there was going to be a change in immediately.
And what about in the legislature? Have you heard of any proposals either from the Walker administration, should they be reelected, that they'd put into their next budget, or are legislators looking at this at all?
We haven't heard anything yet. The legislature will return kind of in January next year, and that's when policy discussions will really start to ramp up.
And what are you watching for going forward here?
Well, we'd like to see what the service center data looks like at individual places. So are wait times substantially worse in one service center versus another? So we have a pending records request for data about that. And we'll also be looking to see if lawmakers address this next year.
All right. Well, and as that story develops, I'm sure we'll revisit this. Keegan, thank you so much. Keegan Kyle, investigative reporter for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. His recent piece there explores why people are waiting longer at the Wisconsin DMV. Keegan, thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
No waiting for programming here on the Ideas Network. Our program does continue. I'm John Munson. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network of WPR. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Voters will head to the polls tomorrow to decide whether to re-elect Governor Scott Walker to a rare third term in office. Governor Walker faces Democratic challenger Tony Evers in what polling suggests is his toughest race yet. As Sean Johnson reports, the circumstances couldn't be more different than when Walker was first elected 8 years ago.
In 2010, Republicans around the country captured 11 governor's offices previously held by Democrats. Winners that year included Sam Brownback.
No more Obama way, now to the Kansas way.
John Kasich.
Guess what? I'm going to be governor of Ohio.
And Scott Walker.
Tonight, I want to tell every worker, every family, and every business, big or small in this state, that you have an ally in the governor's office. Wisconsin is open for business.
Walker is the only governor from that group who's running for a third term. Marquette University pollster Charles Franklin says it's a different landscape than in Walker's previous runs, because for the first time, there's a Republican president in the White House.
Those are things that almost always work against the president's party, whether we're talking about congressional or gubernatorial elections. So Walker's facing headwinds on the national scene this year that he's not confronted in his previous elections.
Democratic ads in this race have hammered home Walker's tenure in office. 8 years, they say, is long enough. They've also reminded people of Walker's brief run for president in 2015.
So who do you think will really help our kids? The politician who put his ambition ahead of our schools, or the teacher who's dedicated his life to making them better?
Those ads have downplayed Tony Evers' political experience, talking less about his three successful runs for state superintendent of public instruction and more about his early career as an educator. While Evers praised Walker's most recent budget, he's criticized Walker's earlier school funding cuts and promised to spend more on schools if he's elected.
This election is bigger than Scott Walker, and frankly, it's bigger than me. This election is about our kids.
Walker has also talked about his 8 years in office, but he frames it as a warning.
Remember back 8 years ago, this state was suffering. It was a mess. We had double-digit tax increases, billion-dollar budget deficits, and record job loss.
The close election has pushed both candidates into unfamiliar territory. After saying earlier in the race that he was open to raising taxes, Evers has been promoting a substantial new income tax cut. And with polls showing the Affordable Care Act's protections for pre-existing conditions extremely popular, Walker has promised to safeguard them in state law.
So enough with the scare tactics. In Wisconsin, pre-existing conditions are covered. And as long as I'm governor, they always will be.
That ad caught President Obama's attention when he visited Milwaukee to campaign for Evers. Obama noted that Walker was making the claim at the same time he was authorizing Wisconsin's participation in a lawsuit that seeks to overturn the ACA.
That is some kind of goal. That is some kind of chutzpah. But let's also call it what it is. It is a lie.
President Donald Trump has also gotten involved in Walker's race. And despite his relatively poor approval rating with independent voters, Wisconsin Republicans have welcomed him. Trump and Walker appeared together at a Mosinee rally last week, where Trump praised Walker for helping bring Foxconn to Wisconsin and called the governor a great friend.
Scott fights every day for you, and now we need you to fight for him. And all you have to do is go out and vote.
The high-profile visits have continued. Vice President Mike Pence campaigned in Wisconsin over the weekend. Former Vice President Joe Biden visited days before that. Walker's attempt at a third term in office has not gone unnoticed, and it's not coming easy. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, some voters across the country are angry, and with an election tomorrow, they'll likely be taking that anger with them to the polls. And while political anger is nothing new, many feel like it's being amplified in the age of Donald Trump. We'll talk with an anger expert about how the emotion is being used by both candidates and voters these days, what all this political anger is doing to us, and what, if anything, can be done about it. Are you feeling angry about politics these days? If so, what's behind that? Will you be casting a ballot tomorrow based on your anger? How do you manage feelings of anger you might have over politics today? Do you ever take this anger online? If so, what does that look like? And what do you think all this anger is doing to us? 800-642-1234. Share your story, 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org is the email address. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Ryan Martin is a professor of psychology and the chair of the psychology department at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. He is also the co-host of the podcast on anger and violence called All the Rage. Ryan Martin, welcome to the morning show.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Certainly, anger plays a key role in any election. After all, getting voters mad about the current guy in office is a strategy that candidates have used for decades. And yet today, well, it just kind of feels different and not in a good way. Are we angrier than ever when it comes to politics?
You know, it sure feels that way. I'll start by saying that I'm not sure we have any way of knowing that for sure. But I do think it feels that this election in particular is one where voters are particularly angry about what's going on. And I think that's true on both sides.
I want to make sure that we're on the same page here. Can you briefly address what you mean or what we mean when we use the word anger? What is anger and what isn't anger?
So I'm really, really glad you asked that, because I do think this is something that is often misunderstood. So I'll start by saying that anger is an emotion. It's a feeling state. It's a lot like, you know, fear. It's a lot like sadness or even happiness. But it's just the feeling state, and it's separate from some of the behaviors that we oftentimes associate with anger. So aggression, for example, which is, you know, a behavior where there is an intent to harm someone, is separate from anger. Now, a lot of times when people are angry, they might lash out physically or verbally and try and harm someone, but that is separate. And the reason that's so important is because there's lots of ways to express your anger, right? You can express your anger by yelling and screaming. You can express your anger through violence. You can also express it by writing letters to the editor. You can express it by going to the polls. So there's lots of adaptive, healthy ways for us to express our anger as well.
What differentiates anger from just simple frustration?
Well, I would, by and large, I think frustration is a specific type of anger. And in one way, it tends to be a little bit more mild than, say, someone who is kind of livid with rage or something like that. But also, we tend to think of, and this is really getting like sort of inside baseball a little bit, but when we talk about frustration, we're oftentimes talking about someone who is having a difficult time meeting their goals, right? And so their attempts at accomplishing something are frustrated.
Mm-hmm. We're with Ryan Martin today. He's a professor of psychology and the chair of the psychology department at UW-Green Bay. Are you feeling angry about politics these days? And if so, what do you think's behind that? Are you casting a ballot tomorrow based on anger? And how do you manage feelings of anger you might have over politics today? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Ryan, what do you think is at the root of the political anger we're seeing these days?
You know, I think there's a lot of things. And I'll start with the fact that anger is, in my opinion, oftentimes an appropriate and reasonable response to politics. I think if you think of anger, as I do, as a valuable tool in alerting us to problems, in motivating us to confront those problems, I think it's perfectly reasonable for people to get angry about elected officials and candidates, right? Because they are capable of acting irresponsibly. They're capable of endorsing positions that harm us. That ultimately the decisions that politicians and leaders make, those affect us, and sometimes they affect us in negative ways. And so I think it's reasonable for people to get angry when that happens. But that's obviously not the only thing. And I think that what happens is during election time in particular, during campaign season, is that we see these exaggerated claims, what you hear candidates also call lies, being thrown out by candidates through their ads or through their stump speeches. And those have a habit of, they do two things. So if you're a supporter of the candidate who might be exaggerating, that, it sort of dichotomizes you. And it says, well, okay, so my candidate is right. Look at all these other terrible things this other person has done. But if you're on the other side and you recognize that those things are exaggerated or lies, it exacerbates your anger at that person.
Are we likelier to get angry about politics than we are other things in our lives?
I don't know if we're more likely there than other things. I will tell you that what seems to bring out the rage online in particular is politics and sports.
Well, the two are kind of related.
Yes, they certainly can be. But if you look to discussion forums, if you look to social media, the things that people tend to express their anger over are politics and sports. And they do actually, I think, have some things in common. And one of them is the tendency to dichotomize, right? My person's the best, your person's the worst.
That's right. We love the Packers and we don't like the Bears. I get it. It's got to be more than that. And our conversation will continue. We'll get into more of this with Ryan Martin, professor of psychology and chair of the psychology department at UW Green Bay. He's also the co-host of a podcast on anger and violence called All the Rage. He stays with us as our conversation about voter anger continues. I'm John Munson. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Voters across the country are angry. And with the election tomorrow, they'll be taking that anger with them to the polls. Political anger? Well, nothing new about that, but a lot of people feel it's being amplified these days. We're talking with an anger expert about how the emotion is being used by both candidates and voters, what it's doing to us, and what we can do about it. How angry are you about politics these days, and what do you think is behind that? Casting a ballot tomorrow based on anger? Why? You take this anger online. What does that look like? Tell us your story. What do you think this is doing to us? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Ryan Martin is professor of psychology and chair of the psychology department at UW Green Bay. Also the co-host of the podcast on anger and violence called All the Rage. Ryan, let's go to the phones. Jeremy is with us in Racine. Good morning, Jeremy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm more frustrated and disappointed in the current politics and the way things have been being discussed these days more so than ever before. When I talk to a lot of my friends, colleagues at work and things like that, anything that comes to politics, oftentimes I hear a lot of more of an echo chamber than I hear of someone who's coming up with their own opinion on their own. You know, they did a little diligence, they looked it up, they did a little background checking on things, a little research. More so now, it's just you hear a politician, you hear a political pundit on the radio say the same thing, you know, keep the rhythm of their party stances, and you hear it come out of their mouths. And it's a little frustrating for me because the tone is really set from the politicians and the political pundits that are set the tone. Mm-hmm. And the people, they use that as their primary source of information. They don't take any time out to do a background check on any of the issues that they're talking about. They go with what they hear, and they go with it. And that's just the way it is.
All right. Jeremy, we get it. Thank you very much. Ryan Martin, the echo chamber effect is frustrating to Jeremy, among other things.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, and one of the things that makes modern-day elections a little bit different than elections in the past. And what we see is that, you know, there's always been an echo chamber, and that is just, in many ways, sort of purely the function of the fact that we tend to be friends with people like us, right, that have things in common with us. And so we end up hearing some of the same arguments lots and lots of times. Social media has obviously exacerbated this, and it's done it in two ways. One, one, we're friends with people like us on social media as well, and so we see some of the same perspectives over and over. The other piece of it, though, has to do with the algorithms that most social media platforms use that expose us to things we agree with, and that is ultimately the point. And so, you know, we're consistently sort of bombarded with these messages that are consistent with our own worldview, which makes it even harder for us to understand how the other side is thinking and feeling. Right?
How do the candidates take advantage of this kind of anger?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I think, one, they continue to pitch that particular perspective, and they're obviously using social media that way. They try to make people angry in a way that people will turn to social media to voice those frustrations, which they know is a common sort of coping mechanism that people will use.
Is anger oftentimes the product of fear?
Yeah, I think it often is. You know, one of the fear and anger share a lot in common. For starters, the physiological piece, right? That they feel very similar. Sometimes I think what happens is that fear can turn into anger because, you know, when something bad happens to you, you oftentimes feel a little bit helpless. And a way in which you can feel a little less helpless is by turning that into anger in some ways, often unintentionally. And that it ends up being sort of an empowering emotion, especially if you do something with it. And so I think for some people, these two things are related, and it manifests itself as anger as a way of kind of trying to solve that problem.
Let's take a call. We'll go to Kathy in Milwaukee next. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Hi. I'm, you know, I get angry or frustrated with Americans for being in willingness denial. That's what I call it, being a willing denial, because there's been such blatant lies, you know, which I'm sure I don't have to mention where they're coming from. But, you know, the fact that people are just swallowing this up, like you said, you know, fitting into what they want to believe instead of actually investigating, it makes me so frustrated, and I get angry, like, you are choosing to be in denial.
Okay.
And I feel like that's my frustration and anger.
Sure. Thanks for sharing that perspective, Kathy. Ryan, does anger really drive voter turnout?
It really does seem to, and politicians know this. There have been studies about how people are more likely to click on online ads that make them angry or make them scared. And if you think about that from a monetary perspective, there's an incentive. You can get more bang for your buck if your ad actually makes people angry. In fact, twice as much. And that people will be that much more likely to click on it. And so we know that anger drives people's behaviors that way. And we need to, and therefore they try to take advantage of that.
Certainly at this moment in time, much of the attention here is being paid to Donald Trump and the Republican Party, who have successfully channeled the country's anger into the presidency and control of Congress. But are both parties guilty here?
I think in different ways. I do think that regardless of party, that is a strategy. I do think we're seeing something very different in the language that our president uses versus the language other past presidents have used. And his, President Trump's willingness to, I think, mock or condone acts of aggression throughout, and this isn't new, but this is kind of throughout his campaign, I think is different than what we've seen from past presidents.
Let's take some more calls here. We'll start in Milwaukee, where Mike is with us. Mike, good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, you just covered pretty much what I wanted to cover. But these ads are designed to go to those exact places that motivate people to be angry and to feel threatened, and so that to raise fear. The Russians. And everybody's afraid of the Russians, and it's a deep-seated fear from the Cold War, maybe even further back. Wilson used it with Bernays, with his marketing and Freudian psychology to get people frightened, to identify those things that frighten people the most. And people are more likely with the inner biology, the amygdala overrules the frontal cortex. And they know the science of this, and so these ads are designed. So people getting so angry, it's a science, and I almost think it's immoral. But and a lot of that a lot of lies are used to do this,
okay.
And so we're motivated by a lot of external influences more so than what we would be capable of doing without it.
Mike, thanks for that. Let's go to Jeff in Stevens Point now. Jeff, welcome to the morning show.
Hey, good morning. I'm going to echo the sentiments of some of the other callers. I'm not going to go to the votes angry or to the polls angry. I am going to go frustrated when I do know that every ad I hear is a half-truth from both sides. But then when you look at the anger part of this, I think it's one where it's kind of easy to follow the money of who's making the money off of this, who's really driving the anger. It's the people selling the ads. Indeed, shows like this that are just talking about it that make it worse. There is some responsibility that does go to the politicians, absolutely. But I will go frustrated, not angry.
Okay.
And I will cast my vote knowing that Wisconsin's in a better place right now than we were 8 years ago.
All right, Jeff, thanks so much for sharing that. And Ryan, those two calls back to back, a lot to chew on there.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that has come up a couple times here is, and I think this is relatively new, though not totally new, and that is anger at other voters. I think that is something we've been talking a lot about, anger at candidates and how people are mad at candidates for X, Y, and Z. But what a lot of these calls have had in common are, feelings of anger at other voters for not paying attention or for accepting things at face value or for agreeing with bad people and so on. And then I think speaks to another aspect of politics that ends up bringing out some anger, and that is the feelings of isolation that that campaigns can bring out. You get a very clear answer to the question, how many people agree with you through a campaign. And that can, when you're on the losing side, it's easy to feel isolated. I can't believe so many other people feel this way. And that can bring out feelings of resentment and frustration.
And what's all this anger doing to us?
Yeah, I tend to approach anger from the perspective of it is a healthy and powerful force in our lives. Anger is a good thing. It has actual evolutionary value, and it exists because it helps us. That said, it clearly too much of it can be problematic. It can cause physiological health problems, cardiovascular disorders, chronic pain, muscle tension, things like that. It can also damage relationships. The running joke about Thanksgiving and people arguing with family, that's a real thing. And it can damage family relationships and other sorts of relationships. And that's legit.
We're going to continue this discussion in just a moment. A lot of angry callers. We'll try and get to as many of them as we can. Ryan Martin is professor of psychology and chair of the psychology department at UW Green Bay. We're talking about how angry we are going to the polls tomorrow. I'm John Munson. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Voter anger is what's on our mind this morning. Are you going to vote tomorrow? Are you angry as you consider your choices? We're talking about voter anger, and we want to hear your story. How do you manage those feelings of anger you might have over politics today? Are you voting because of anger tomorrow? And what do you think all this anger is doing to us? 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Ryan Martin is with us. He's professor of psychology and chair of the Department of Psychology at UW Green Bay. Let's go back to the phone. Saeed is with us from Green Bay. Saeed, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Yes, good morning, and thank you very much for taking my call. I want to go back to your speaker's answer to the question, do both political parties use this tactic? And I have to say that his emphasis is too much on semantics and not enough on substance. Because Donald Trump uses politically incorrect language, he becomes easily identifiable in this way. However, I was in Chicago during the last presidential election when a planned political rally was shot down by threats of violence. And later, when the DNC emails got revealed, I found out that That was a mob that was hired and trained by the Democrats. A mob that was trained in producing violence in political rallies to shut down free speech. There is no such equivalent on the other side. So let us not forget a substance and not get lost in language.
Okay, Saeed, thank you for your perspective. Saeed, taking you to task there, Ryan.
Yeah, I'm not sure I can comment on whether or not I think it's probably unreasonable to say that there is no such equivalent on the other side. But I suspect we wouldn't know that. We certainly have seen examples of a lot of examples of rhetoric on the other side, making accusations that aren't entirely accurate. But I don't know that there's much more to say about it.
All right. Well, let's move on then. Is there a point where extreme anger over politics reaches kind of a tipping point where it devolves into threats and even physical violence?
I certainly think there is. We've seen cases where certainly there are threats, and I think actually one of the really, really alarming places where you'll see threats and aggression is online. And so you'll see examples of groups targeting other groups online and encouraging harassment that way. You've certainly seen rallies at which there have been acts of violence in the past. And so it can certainly get to that point.
Let's take a call next from Nate in Milwaukee. Nate, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Hi, thank you. I actually was thinking about the substance and how it relates to my emotions. I'm concerned about gerrymandering, which is basically a way to not have honest elections. And I'm anxious because of how close the race for governor is, but I'm hopeful because I figure if Evers wins, that would guarantee that gerrymandering goes away, and I think that'd be good for the state in a number of ways beyond this one election. But one of the things that would potentially get me angry is with all the polls out about how the House might potentially flip parties. If it doesn't, and I know gerrymandering affects other states and also affects the different House districts across the U.S., I feel like the election would have been swung by gerrymandering if the House stays in the current party's hands by a little bit, because that would mean that basically it wasn't honestly done and they cheated, in my mind, to hold on to power.
All right. Now, Nate, thanks for that. Nate is anxious, and we talked earlier about how anxiety and fear and anger are related, Ryan.
Yeah, and I think that's another good example of what I would say anger and fear as appropriate. I mean, I think the caller really provided some good examples of how the outcome of the election will affect have very real effects on representative government in this case, talking about gerrymandering and things like that. I think we have to acknowledge that the politicians make decisions, and those decisions affect the lives of everyone in the state in this case.
Many people have taken their anger, their political anger, to the internet. We touched on that a little bit earlier, but we've seen a lot of nasty fights break out in the comment sections of news articles and Facebook status posts, and let's not even get started on Twitter. Is this a healthy or unhealthy way to be expressing our anger?
By and large, we find that it's not a healthy way to express anger. There's a lot of reasons why people turn to why the internet brings out anger in ways that face-to-face don't necessarily, including in some cases there's anonymity. But even when there's not anonymity, there's I think some social distance that plays a role. You're further away from the person that you're speaking to, and so you can't see their facial expressions. It's just harder to communicate some of those things. But ultimately, we know that people will say things online that they wouldn't necessarily say in person, and that often leads to damaged relationships and other sorts of problems.
Well, and it's easy to just type something and hit send without even thinking about it, and maybe we've made it too simple. But do you think social media desensitizes us to anger?
I think social media impacts anger and other emotions in an infinite number of ways. And one of the things it does is that it exposes us to all sorts of new and different different provocations than we were once exposed to. We, you know, every day we see things that we wouldn't have necessarily seen 10 years ago, and that's because, you know, our friends are posting about it. So we may become exposed to friends of ours who have political perspectives that are different from ours, or friends of ours who espouse racist beliefs that we didn't know about in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And those things tend to drive anger in ways, in these new ways. So, and yeah, it might desensitize us to some of that. We kind of get used to it.
So give us, we tend to live in a state of perpetual outrage these days.
Right.
What are some healthy ways, though, that we could channel our anger over politics?
You know, I think about think about pro-social actions. So what are the things that human beings can do that can affect the world in a positive way? And I think voting is one of those. I think I don't actually think there's anything wrong with taking your anger online, provided you try and do it in a way that is well-reasoned and persuasive instead of just hostile and intending to, so often I think what people post is intended to harm someone. And trying to find ways around that. I think going to rallies, I think there are all sorts of these kind of positive ways that people can write poetry, they can register voters, they can create art. There's lots of good, healthy ways to express our anger. And typically, we need to think of them as things that don't necessarily, that where the intent isn't to harm someone or something.
Well, I suppose in the 50s and 60s, we could have all sat down and written protest songs. Are there some strategies that we might be able to use to avoid that anger in the first place?
Yeah, I think one of the decisions that people can make is kind of thinking about what they consume when it comes to media and the ads they watch and things like that. And, you know, at a certain point, I had made my decision about who I was going to vote for, and I decided I wasn't going to just continue to expose myself to all of the ads. They were things that weren't necessarily doing any good. They were making me angry. It seemed more reasonable for me to pass on that. People will accuse me of saying, well, you're just burying your head in the sand, you know, but that's not what I'm suggesting. I'm suggesting that if these sorts of media things don't have a positive, if they have an unhealthy impact on you, then choose not to expose yourself to them, the same way I don't go see horror movies and the same way I don't, do other sorts of things that have a negative effect on me. That doesn't mean I'm saying disengage from the process. I'm saying engage in the process in a way that's smart.
All right. Ryan Martin, thank you so much for joining us this morning. I really appreciate your time.
You bet. Thank you.
Ryan Martin, professor of psychology and the chair of the psychology department at the UW-Green Bay, also the host of co-host of a podcast on anger and violence called All the Rage. Remember, our election coverage starts tomorrow night at 7, so don't miss it. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.